You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
I'm David Halpin. I run the UK's Behavioural Insights team, where we've been doing otherwise known as the Nudge Unit for the last few years in the UK, using kind of behaviourally based approaches, essentially trying to introduce a more realistic account of human behaviour into policymaking. And as some of you may know, it's actually worked quite well in a whole range of domestic policy areas. And it's gone from being a kind of fringy, slightly nutty idea from about 5 years ago into something which is really quite core now and increasingly used in many countries across the world. Anyway, it has been a really fascinating area. A lot of things that come to government, a new fashionable idea, you know, it kind of comes and goes. Where this one, it feels like it's got very deep roots. And many of you will be aware of, there's also other books out at the moment. There's Richard Thaler's just published his book on misbehaving, which is a great read also, is an account of it. We've all been having a lot of media from Steve Hilton, who's reflecting on actually quite a related issue in his new book, More Human. But in many ways, while the rest of us are often worrying about a little bit of the world in terms of UK, what's been fascinating and really welcoming is that the World Bank has become very interested in this issue. So I'll introduce Farron in a second in a bit more detail, but it was certainly very welcome to us, I think, to see the World Bank engaging in this. In fact, DFID, I think, gave it some support also as a project. And my understanding is that in the first 5 months, this year's World Development Report, which we're going to hear more about in a minute, had more downloads in the first 5 months than any other World Development Report has had over its entire kind of history. So that's very encouraging indeed. So Farron, I've got to know quite a bit on and off through the years, not least in terms of the background to this report. He himself is a senior economist with the Development Research Group of the World Bank. He's published widely in leading journals in the fields of political science, development, economics, and his work's been covered in New York Times, Economist, Washington Post, to name but a few. He's held post as a visiting lecturer in public and international affairs at Princeton University and as visiting professor in the Department of Economics in San Diego, Chile. So he, of course, was the co-director and co-author of the 2015 World Development Report. And so tonight he's joined us really to take you through some of those findings. It is a great report. It's quite long, but it's very readable, I think, and I really commend it to you, those who haven't read it, but hopefully you're going to get the gist of it tonight. And Farron hopefully will give us a sense also of how it's being picked up going forward in the bank and beyond. So without further ado, we welcome Farron.
Thank you so much. Thanks to RSA for putting together this lovely event in this lovely room. It's really very much a pleasure and an honor to be here. And thank you, David, for the introductions and for your support of this work over the past many months. David was kind enough to come to the launch event of the World Development Report many months ago and played, I think, really a very important role in urging us to move forward with the operational agenda after finishing the report. So let me tell you a little bit about the report and our main messages. We can sum it up in one single sentence, which is that development policy, development assistance, and public policy more generally are ready for a redesign based on a more realistic understanding of how human beings think, behave, decide. In the standard approach, what governments typically do is set up institutions, create rules of the game, provide resources, affect prices through taxes and subsidies, and then step back and let people navigate their own course through life. In many respects, that's quite appropriate, and it's very powerful. But it's also, in some ways, incomplete. And to understand a little bit about why it's incomplete, I want to start with a metaphor, which is flying an airplane. It's not something I have ever done. It's a challenging, vertiginous kind of task, especially so if you are in a cockpit that looks like this. This is taken from a plane designed in the 1960s. For technological reasons, each piece of information was mapped to a single dial: altitude, wind speed, air pressure, temperature. It was up to the pilot to visually scan all this information, to remember what it said a few minutes ago, and then integrate it when it came time to make a decision, like choosing an angle of approach for a runway. This was linked to pilot error, and so as a result, experts in the area of human factors design were called in. Modern cockpits now look like this. They allow pilots to set certain information to be displayed as a default and hide other bits of information. They're less cognitively demanding. They're easier to fly, and pilot error has gone down. It's also true that social relations in the cockpit matter. Studies have shown that typically captains issue twice as many orders as first officers, even though first officers are sitting in the cockpit, and that first officers tend to issue their orders as suggestions. Sir, you might want to lower your wheels now. You can understand why the free flow of information is very important for these kinds of decisions. In 2013, the American Heart Association came out with a study that found that social hierarchy in the operating room is also linked to surgical error on the part of cardiac surgeons. Being on the same page in the operating room is also important. It's important for people in that room to have the same mental model. That's also linked to lower rates of surgical error. So if we can redesign the cockpit for pilots so that they can navigate better, we should be able to do the same for individuals as they navigate their course through their lives. Too much information can be overwhelming. Redesigning the information environment, the social environment, can help people make better decisions about their education, about their savings, about their health care, and about a variety of other domains of life as well. In traditional development policy, the assumption was that people make decisions deliberatively on the basis of consistent and self-interested preferences and explicit information. In the report, we argue that we need to rethink how people decide and behave. People think automatically. They usually draw on what comes to mind effortlessly. They think socially. We're deeply social beings, and social norms guide much of our behavior. And finally, we think with mental models. Information coming in is filtered through our conception of the world and of ourselves. It's important to keep in mind. I want to take you through each of these in turn. In thinking automatically, we often look through a window frame, and we make an assumption that what we see through the frame is, in fact, the whole world, when it just may not be. To illustrate this, let's play a little bit of a game. This is a game that cognitive psychologists like to call Add 3. So you may want to join and speak aloud. Add 3 to each of these digits. If it's a 4, it becomes a 7. If it's a 7, if it's an 8, make it a 1. You know, don't carry the 1, but just an 8 will turn to 1. So for this, the answer is what? Very good. How about this one? Not bad. How about this one? Okay. And this one? Good. So if you are like the average person in Daniel Kahneman's classic experiment, your heartbeat has just increased 7 beats per minute, your pupils have dilated 50%, your blood pressure has gone up. Thinking hard actually takes biological energy. That's why most of us avoid thinking hard whenever we have the opportunity. We have evolved the capacity to think automatically, on autopilot, very quickly and in many domains very effectively. We can decide, for instance, whether someone is angry at you. If I'm running along, Myri or David might look at me funny. I'll pick that up very fast. If you want to compare the size of two objects, which is bigger, you can do that. But try comparing two proportions. It's a much more demanding task. What often happens is that we think automatically when what's called for is more analytic thinking. Sometimes that automatic thinking, and very often, it helps us, but sometimes it can get in the way. Let me give you some examples. Think about this problem. Now compare it to this problem. It's obviously, the answer is the same. But in a classic experiment, the people who are given the first problem gave systematically lower answers than people who are given the second problem. Here were the results. You can see that everybody was pretty far off. But what people were doing was that they were anchoring on that first number. They thought 1, and they tended to move lower. Other people saw the 8, and they tended to move higher. That's automatic thinking. Now, this is an example from mathematics and arithmetic, but it's also true in economic and social life more generally. you've probably heard that one effective way to use automatic thinking is to automatically enroll people in retirement savings. And automatically enrolling people and asking them to opt out has been shown to be more effective than a 50% subsidy trying to entice people to opt in. Let me give you a similar example from education. The ACT is a university entrance exam in the United States. From 1991 to 1996, students were allowed to send 3 reports to universities for free. The 4th report cost $6. This was changed in 98, and in 2000, 4 reports could be sent free. You can see that in each year, except for the transition year, people were just doing the default. They were following that anchor and sending out as many reports as were allowed for free. Now, when you send a 4th report to a university and you're a low-income student, you're more likely to get into a more selective college. The payoff to going into a more selective college is $10,000 of lifetime income. So what happened from 1991 to 1996 is that people were forgoing $10,000 of lifetime income to save $6 in the moment. Not a good calculation. They were just anchoring and using the default that was provided by the testing service. Applying to college is a challenging task. It involves a lot of paperwork. If you're applying for financial aid, as I just mentioned, it can leave you feeling very confused. In an interesting experiment, people realized that most of what is needed to apply for financial aid is in fact available on your tax forms. And tax preparers in the United States, individuals were asked, would you like to spend another 10 minutes filling out your financial aid form for your kids? They went through an online procedure, interactive form like this, which populated the financial aid forms. Individuals who took these 10 minutes, and they were randomly chosen, were more likely to apply for financial aid, they were more likely to receive financial aid, and for those kids who lived with their parents in the left column here, they were 30% more likely to actually enroll in college. A similar story takes place in developing countries. In Tangier and Morocco, households, typically the women in the households, spend 7 to 9 hours per week collecting water from communal taps. The town, the municipality, provided a subsidy to people to sign up for a home water hookup, but only 10% of the people actually did so. In an intervention, people went to houses, randomly selected houses, and said, we'll help you apply. They took photographs of the necessary forms and then took them to the municipality. The take-up rate went up to 69% from a baseline of 10%. And people had suddenly more time in their hands when they didn't have to go collect water. Cognition takes energy, and so does willpower. In Mysore, India, data entry clerks were paid a piece rate for each bit of data they entered correctly. But nevertheless, some of them didn't work as hard as they wanted to work. It was noticed that they increased their productivity 8% on payday and 15% just before major festivals when they wanted money for presents or for other goodies. Some of you may know from your own experience that your productivity increases right before a deadline, or if it's not you, it's your kids or someone else that you know. These data entry workers were offered a commitment contract in which they could agree to the following terms. If they met their own self-chosen targets, they were paid as usual. But if they failed to meet these targets, their pay was docked. About a third of the workers accepted this commitment contract, and they increased their productivity by 6%. To achieve that level of productivity increase, you'd have to increase wages by 18%. People don't necessarily know themselves, but offering a commitment contract can motivate themselves to work harder. Economically, this is sort of irrational because there's only a downside. But if you're sophisticated about your own willpower and challenges, this kind of contract can make sense. In Kenya, savings for healthcare is often a challenge. Individuals were given a lockbox in which they would put in money to save for health emergencies. They also labeled the lockbox for the preventive healthcare product of their choice, like an insecticide-treated bed net. they held the key to the lock. So it wasn't a hard commitment, but people given this key and lockbox increased their savings for health emergencies by 70%. Interestingly, those who were given the opportunity to sign up for a hard commitment, in which the researcher had to come and open up the lockbox, did not increase their savings. The hard commitment didn't work in this context, partly because people turned it down. They wanted the flexibility to use that money for something else if needed, but having the lockbox, having that label, created a kind of mental account in their heads so that they would actually save for health emergencies. Following through on immunization can be a challenge. Many of the key childhood immunizations are administered to children when they approach 1 year of age. The first few months, mothers are often in contact with healthcare providers. They remember to do the immunization, but following through can be hard. In Rajasthan, in Udaipur, in the rural areas of Udaipur, baseline immunization rates were about 2%. It was a disadvantaged tribal area in India. The intervention in this case involved a camp helping people to sign up for, avail themselves of immunization, but also 3/4 of a kilo of dried lentils for each immunization shot, as well as a traditional metal dish, set of dishes, a thali, when you completed your course of immunizations. What's noticeable is that these kinds of incentives and reminders had an impact on the later immunizations, not just the first ones. It helped people carry through on their commitment all through the course of the immunization process and boosted immunization rates dramatically. This intervention also lowered the overall cost of immunizations. This is quite striking. A subsidy actually made the program cheaper. The reason is that because although the camps had to stay open from 11 to 2, when more people were using them, the unit cost of immunization went down. So a subsidy absolutely made the program cheaper. So those are a variety of ways in which thinking automatically can be leveraged on the part of policymakers to make development policies more effective. Let me tell you a little bit about the idea of thinking socially. I'll start with a story. In January of 1997, the main water tunnel to the city of Bogota, Colombia, collapsed. It didn't precipitate an immediate water crisis because an emergency reservoir was available. But if no action was taken, 70% of the city would be without water in a few months. The mayor at the time was Antanas Mockus, a trained philosopher and a very interesting guy. He had launched a program called Citizenship Culture, in which he wanted to motivate people to participate in city life. This had already been associated with a decline in homicides, traffic fatalities, and an increase in voluntary tax payments, and he thought this would be another opportunity to use citizenship culture. The first thing they did was to publicize the fact that there was a water crisis. 90% of people in a few days later said they had heard about the crisis. The publicity was effective, but water consumption was actually increasing, not going down. Why? Because when people thought about it, they realized, I better get my water now before it's all gone. So then the city changed course. They did a number of interesting things based on a fairly deep understanding of the social side of human nature. They passed out stickers, which were to be attached right to the faucet. These stickers were of San Rafael, which was the name of the water reservoir. This reminded people not to use water when they had a choice. They also publicized in the newspapers the amount of water that was being consumed in the city. This way, those people who were saving realized that other people are saving too, and their actions have made a difference. They weren't the sucker, but they were part of a larger effort in which social norms were potentially changing. They also gave out awards to individuals who were particularly good at saving water, and they talked about businesses that weren't necessarily productive in this area, like car washes. They also, in the newspaper, publicized the names of individuals who were doing a good job. Alejandro Gomez, who was age 25, was asked in this article, what do you do to save water? And he said, well, I soap myself up before turning on the shower, and I also take a shower with someone else. And you might think, well, that's great. He's unusual. But the mayor himself had appeared on TV a week earlier taking a shower with his wife and asked people to do the same, you know, maybe have a little bit of fun while they're at it. And Alejandro was very pleased to comply with his mayor's request. The combined efforts resulted in a reduction in water consumption that stayed low for many years. At a peak, it was 14% pre-crisis levels. Another tunnel, which was going to be built to supply water to Bogota, didn't have to be built. So this is a story about social norms, social networks. They used religious leaders to get the word out as well, and about cooperation that can be leveraged as a policy tool. Typically, economists think that everyone is a free rider, but in fact, when you play what are called public goods games in the lab across countries, most people are not free riders. In this particular study, the number of free riders was 5 to 40%. Most people actually want to cooperate, but they want to be sure that others are, in fact, as well. This can be leveraged for policymaking. In Zambia, hairdressers were selling female condoms. Randomly, one-fourth of hairdressers were given a 90% commission for every condom sold. One-fourth were given a 10% commission. One-fourth were given their gold stars next to their name in the salon, and one-quarter were just the control group. The impact was that those who were given the stars, the recognition, significantly increased their condom sales, whereas the commissions, those given financial commissions, did not. Now, the suggestion is not that we should all give up our salaries and live on gold stars. The hairdressers themselves, for them, the commissions were a small share of overall income. But still, it's an example of how recognition can motivate very effectively. Traffic accidents are a large problem in many parts of the world. 1.25 million deaths per year from traffic accidents. It's a big problem in Kenya as well. People ride these collective vehicles called matatus. How do you get people to drive more safely? Regulations didn't seem to be working in Kenya. What did work was a sticker. A sticker was placed randomly on buses. The sticker said, "Don't just sit there as he drives dangerously. Stand up, speak up now." The sticker was activating a social norm to get people to protest when the driver was not driving safely. The impact was a decline from 10% to 5% in insurance claims regarding injury or death in vehicles that had these buses. Latrine use is a challenge in developing countries. Outdoor defecation is a major problem. There's a major campaign in India and elsewhere to reduce outdoor defecation, which is linked to malnourishment and undernourishment among children. But how do you get people to use latrines? You can build them, but sometimes then they're used for grain storage or to replace animals. Why use them? They can be unsafe, they can be dangerous, they can be smelly. If no one else is using them, what's the health benefit to you if everyone else keeps engaging in the same behavior? What can sometimes work is collective behavior change, in which villages as a whole jointly agree to change their behavior, and leveraging social emotions to try and change behavior. Interventions like this reduced open defecation rates in randomly selected villages in India by 11% and Indonesia by 7%. You might not think those are large numbers, but they're significant because of the impact on child health. Social networks are also very powerful. In Malawi, when farmers were given instructions and encouragement to use new seeds and new fertilizer by peers that had a larger impact than when they were given instructions by government extension workers. Let me turn now to our third idea, which is that people think with mental models. We filter what happens out there in the world. When the English settlers went to Jamestown, Virginia in 1607, they thought they could grow olives, pomegranates, figs, and tangerines. On the common sense view that latitude, that climate is constant at any given latitude. They persisted in trying to grow these things for the entire 13 years of the settlement from 1607 to 1620. One year it was cold and they thought, it's anomalously cold, next year it'll be better. And another year they thought, if it was cold again, next year it'll be better. Eventually, their model was updated, but it cost a lot in terms of lives and money. Climate is a mental model. If you base your understanding of climate on observation alone, it will take a long time to update your views. On the common sense model or view or assumption that you only change your views about climate if the current high is one standard deviation above the historical high for three consecutive years, it'll take you 86 years to update your model of climate and believe that it's truly changed and it's not just an anomalous year. We have a model for what climate is. We also have models about what causes a disease, about what a government should do, about social roles. We also have models for an ideal family size. The fertility rate fell sharply in Brazil from 1960 to about 2000. Why? It's a little unclear, because the government was generally pro-natalist at this time. It wanted people to have kids to populate the interior of the country, the Amazon. One thing that may have played a role was soap operas. People watched soap operas and saw, and their model of an ideal the ideal family size may have changed. People have linked, researchers have linked the appearance of O Globo, the Brazilian soap opera cable TV network, to a decline in family size, and have also linked, amusingly, the appearance of the soap, the availability of the soap opera in a given municipality with the number of times a character's name from the soap opera was given to children in that municipality. So people were paying attention. Another mental model is the idea that something is free. When something is free, it means something to us. In a series of studies in sub-Saharan Africa, the Poverty Action Lab found that users are willing to use something, to adopt, to accept and use a preventive health product like an insecticide-treated bed net or deworming if it's free, but not if it costs a few cents. If something is free, people think differently about it. It's somehow emotionally charged for a variety of reasons. The policy implication is that if something is worth subsidizing, it may be worth subsidizing all the way to zero. Let me say a couple of words about poverty. The World Bank, we have a lot of data on poverty. We all think about poverty a lot. But poverty is not just a shortage of resources, but it's a decision-making context. To illustrate, let's talk about sugarcane farmers in India. Sugarcane farmers in India have a lot of resources after the harvest, but not very many resources before the harvest. Before the harvest, they're much more likely to have pawned their belongings and much more likely to have taken out loans. What does all this preoccupation with money do? It saps cognitive power. They may have a harder time answering questions like that ad three that we did together during these times. Researchers tested the same farmer, and there was a change in 10 IQ points between the time when they had a lot of cash and the time that they didn't, because of the preoccupations that were that they experienced. 10 IQ points is almost the equivalent of losing a night's sleep if you were to take an IQ test. What this means is that we should support decisions when they have to be made in times when bandwidth is scarce, or move those decisions out of times when bandwidth is scarce. In Bogota, Colombia, there was an interesting innovation in which cash transfers were saved and then given to people right before they made an enrollment decision for the next year. And giving people cash right when the big decision was to be made helped them re-enroll. They could have saved that money themselves, but they weren't doing so. That's a way of supporting key decisions. And the financial aid accounts I showed you are also related to that. Now, I've been talking about other people's biases, but what about our biases? What about our shortcomings, mine, yours, everyone in this room? We wanted to find out if World Bank staff have biases. So we... first, let me say we typically think of experts as individuals who see everything, like the wardens in Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon prison, where they look at every single prisoner around there. We asked World Bank staff to tell us whether skin cream A or skin cream B was more effective at reducing rash. Then with the same data, we asked them to tell us whether the minimum wage reduces or lowers poverty rates. We gave them the same table in both contexts, exact same data, to see whether, in an ideological context, they were better or worse. It turns out that World Bank staff were more likely to get the right answer in the minimum wage context than in the skin cream context, even though the data were identical. And you might say that's surprising, given that World Bank staff are trained in this area. Well, it didn't happen despite the fact that World Bank staff are trained in this area. It happened because bank staff are trained in this area. I don't mean to pick on World Bank staff per se. We replicated the same experiment with DFID. And it's a problem generally with biases. If you think you know the answer, you don't follow through and do the math. So we need to think about de-biasing ourselves. And there are a variety of ways to do that that are really quite interesting. Sunk cost bias is another challenge. We asked World Bank staff whether they would commit remaining funds to a dying project and vary the amount of disbursements that had taken place from 30, 50, 70, and 90. It turns out that the more disbursements that had taken place before, the more likely World Bank staff were to continually close the project, which makes no sense because it's dying no matter what. But if you've dispersed a lot of money, you don't want to admit failure. And that turns out to be a challenge. Finally, we asked bank staff whether they could predict the views of the poor. As I mentioned, poverty is not just short of resources, but a mindset. How well do we understand the mindset of poverty? We asked bank staff to predict how individuals in Jakarta, Nairobi, and Lima would answer questions about their self-efficacy and about how much hope they had in their lives. We also asked them to predict whether they agreed with the statement that vaccines are risky because they can cause sterilization. Staff predicted that 42% of poor individuals in Nairobi would agree with the fact that vaccines are risky because they cause sterilization. And we did the same survey in Nairobi, and poor individuals only agreed with that statement 11% of the time. So we can be wrong in our views of how individuals think. What does this mean for operationalization? If you're trying to get people to use clean water, you can have a variety of interventions. You can improve the water source by putting in concrete and pipes. You can deliver chlorine and water to the home. You can put a chlorine dispenser right at the site of the source. Now, you don't know ex ante which of these is going to be most effective. Do you have any guesses about which is going to be most effective? It's hard to know. It turns out that this last one was most effective because in this context, people would often collect the water in containers that were themselves contaminated. In this context, people would often forget to ask for the deliveries. This functioned as a reminder to people to chlorinate the water and was 60% more cost-effective than the other two interventions. What this means is that you don't necessarily know what's going to happen ex ante, and you need to continually refine your efforts. We have to be relentlessly empirical. We don't have a grand theory here. Economists will tell you that when prices go up, people demand less of something and supply more. We don't know what happens with a 10% increase in salience and making something more salient. What does a 10% increase in salience even mean? We don't know. We have to be relentlessly empirical in figuring out how decisions actually take place. So let me wrap up by returning to this cockpit story. In this context, people realize the stakes are high. Airbus, Boeing, they realized that when the design environment isn't right for pilots, crashes can occur, and that's a high-stakes situation. So they redesigned the cockpit. Now, people coming to this talk probably know that development is also a high-stakes situation. Global poverty is a very high-stakes situation. There are over 13 million of preventable deaths that take place every year. More than half of those among kids under the age of 5. So it's incumbent upon all of us, those who work in government, in civil society, for donor organizations, to help redesign the choice environment to help people make decisions in their own best interests. Thank you.
That's great. Stephen, I've looked at it a lot. There's also some new examples in there, which is always nice to see. One of the things that you actually using the example of the cockpit, one of the criticisms made of this area sometimes, you touched on almost at the end, is that it's actually so many different effects and so on and so on. It's quite hard to kind of get a grip on. But, I mean, first of all, to ask in a slightly playful way, I mean, is there an effect or result which is particularly striking in your mind, because you've been so familiar with it now, where you kind of stood out and you think, that really is absolutely amazing? Do you have a favourite? I mean, they're like your kids, you know, you don't have really a favourite. But is there one that you actually do think is especially surprising?
Well, I came across one the other day, David, which I hadn't known, which really jumped out at me. Partly because it's from, it contradicts or is different than a standard economic prediction, which is that British Columbia implemented a carbon tax, I believe in 2008 or 2009, and if you think about the impact of a carbon tax, you would predict a relatively small drop in consumption given the size of the carbon tax that they imposed. But the result was 7 times larger than the predicted effect based on just a price increase. So what that means is that somehow all the conversation about what was going on really changed how people were behaving and acting. And so even in a basic standard area like price elasticity that economists talk about, there's something more going on. We don't know exactly, you know, what the elasticity is going to be of a carbon tax, but it really jumped out at me as thinking we need to really rethink some fundamental assumptions that we have.
So one of the issues you picked up in the end about experts, ourselves are subject to this, even if we think we know where at it, we still are. The World Bank's got 20-odd thousand experts. We've got a lot of people there. It itself presumably is stuck in a certain we all have some fixation. And I wonder how you feel it's going there. So at the launch, I should explain, so the president of the World Bank spoke very powerfully. He'd just come back from Africa, and he'd clearly seen what's happening in relation to Ebola, and his point was it's behavioural from top to bottom. So he's very passionate about it. You've done this report. But to what extent do you think it is really spreading in the bank? And like, what areas is it spreading fast, and what areas is it stuck? Like, what's the kind of fixation that's occurring almost institutionally?
Yeah. So there's a lot of interest in this report, both inside the World Bank and outside in the broader world, which we're pleased to see. We will be setting up a little nudge team, something you know a fair amount about, David, within the institution to begin adding some focus to some of this work. But beyond this little team, there's a lot of interest already ongoing within the institution. There are interesting interventions that try and lift the aspirations of individuals, say, in Peru. There's work that tries to use social norms in letters to increase tax repayments in Guatemala and elsewhere in Central America. There's also a couple very compelling initiatives that look like they're going to go forward in the coming months. One involves sanitation and water. Yeah. I mentioned that there's, you know, this latrine use example, but that's a big item in the agenda of many countries, particularly in South Asia. And how do you get the messaging right? Who's going to be providing the information? How do you test whether the messaging works effectively? That's an area where there's a lot of interest. Road safety is another topic in which there have been a number of conversations about how to change behavior. And it's a great example because it's a good illustration of how this kind of work is applied, because you need to think, well, what's road safety? It's a fairly abstract idea. You need to sort of isolate the key actors, you know, the truckers, the pedestrians, the highway patrol officers, and think about, okay, who are these individuals that are involved in road safety? What choices and decisions are they making, and what can we do to move them in certain directions? So those are a few of the, a few of the, I think, many areas which we'll be working.
So let me ask you one more before you kind of open up. So one of the arguments we get a bit of in the UK, we certainly did in 2010, and I know that Richard and Cass had a lot of in Washington, is that people feel almost uneasy about the approach, often in an Anglo-Saxon context. Like the idea of there are nudges, people like me who are in Downing Street, wherever, are doing this to citizens. But it's interesting, I don't think you've had that pushback. And when you go through the examples in a development context, it doesn't really strike. But I wonder, you know, you're obviously working in a lot of different countries. I use examples from many countries. To what extent are you seeing, is there any issue with the politics? Or actually people just look at it, of course we should do this. And where are we at?
Well, it's still early days. So, you know, we may get some more pushback going forward. But one thing I would say is that in a certain sense, development is already a project in which we're trying to help people make interest for themselves. And we've decided we want people to be more educated. We want people to be healthier. Yeah. We want people not to be poor. So if you come at it from this focus and what Amartya Sen would say, you know, core capabilities or even human rights, then I think the pushback is not quite as strong because the needs are really quite powerful in this area.
That's great. So now you've had a bit of time. Thank you very much. Very good. Why don't we just start? We start at the back and then we'll work around.
Thank you very much for the talk. That was excellent. Brian Kilkelly, World Cities Network. I was prompted by your calculation that it's going to take a long time for people to realize we're in climate change. I think 80-odd years, I think you're saying, which is quite frightening. So I guess in terms of that, that is a huge issue. You know, how do we get people to respond and start to act on climate change? What lessons could we draw from this work to start, making people's behaviour change and people start taking it seriously? Because it feels like in many ways we're flatlined and we're not making the progress we need to make.
Well, climate change is obviously an enormous, complicated problem. A few thoughts. One is that there are a number of ways that behavioral economics and social norms can inspire energy-saving behavior. You may have heard about default settings on thermostats or benchmarking your energy consumption to that of your neighbors, and these turn out to be quite effective. You might respond, and I'm sure so many people have, by saying this is small change, given the size of the problem. But I think that may be true, but I think that response is missing the thought that we need a lot of small changes to really to add up. There may not be a magic bullet. And secondly, even getting people to become more conscientious in their own domains, in their own little lives, may be turning them into voters of a different type as well. So there might be a way in which the consciousness raising is stimulated by some of these, you know, nudges to engage in more energy-conserving behavior as well. And generally speaking, I think the framing of climate change has been sort of as a global tragedy of the commons, and it's left people feeling a little bit helpless. And so we may need to sort of think more concertedly about local solutions and telling people really concretely what to do, what they can do to address the problem, because otherwise they feel like they're, you know, a small drop in the bucket.
Toby Chambers from Goldsmiths. How important is sort of social entrepreneurs actually in the process? Because it has traditionally been more kind of a top-down approach and coming from more a kind of a social entrepreneurship background myself. I see that as the rising stars of solving the problems and actually going to more kind of user-centered design.
There's a lot of interest, obviously, in the design community behind this. There are a lot of organizations working in that area that I think we need to work collaboratively with. A number of initiatives on the parts of civil society organizations in developing countries as well. There's the organization BRAC in Bangladesh has a terrific little bowl which they provide to mothers when their children turn 6 months and a day after the period of exclusive breastfeeding is over. There's a ceremony in which they sort of almost have a birthday kind of thing with a candle. And the bowl is divided into parts, you know, one with lines on it, you know, with one part for the solids, one for the vegetables, the proteins, and the carbohydrates. So it's almost like a little design to help people think through nutrition. It's not nutrition messaging as, you know, do this, so many calories, so many. It's just all in a little line. It's very simple, and it uses a social sort of celebration as well to get the point across. I think it's very powerful and a great example of how, in this case, a social organization is using in social insights as well as design insights to make things better. And there must be 1,000 examples like that. That's the one that struck us as we're doing this report, but there's a lot of energy and creativity in the part of social organizations that are doing this, because on some level, this is, you know, some of this is fairly intuitive. What has happened in recent years is that there's a scientific basis for a lot of it, but I think that a lot of social organizations are using this very effectively already.
Should you take a question at the front, and then...
Yeah, my comment is money in debt, and as you're a banker, or so-called, it's a mythical thing. It doesn't have any gold standard left to it. We keep printing, expanding our debt. We less and less capability of ever paying it back. So why are we supporting this system, which is going nowhere?
Well, I think Keynes may have said something about being in thrall to a debt economist. And in this case, I think people may be in thrall to Keynes. I'm not necessarily sure that's, not sure I'd follow your assumptions all the way down the line about the impact of counter-cyclical monetary expansion. You know, it may be quite powerful in some settings, but I think that's probably a conversation for a different occasion. What I would say is that mental models of policymakers are really quite powerful. And I think in a variety of domains, although people may not agree on whether a particular policy intervention is effective or not, they tend to do what people have done before. And bringing the conversation back to, you know, some of the ideas in the report, if you talk to policymakers in a variety of settings, you ask them, how do you increase, you know, get people to save more? They'd say, well, subsidize it, you know, or provide information. Changing the mental models of policymakers, I think, is the long-term agenda here. I think, you know, if this agenda is successful in 2 or 3 generations, you'll be able to go to a municipality in any corner of the world, and the policymaker would say, well, we also need to target mindsets. And so they would be thinking about it, and they might be aware that they themselves could be enthralled to an old mindset, like this person in your example.
There's certainly questions about non-monetary exchanges, I think, in the development world, which are very powerful and make, in fact, a lot of economies and societies work. And so it's that supplement that plays out as well. Anyway, not for me to do. Question.
Nicholas Watts, Bristol University. Just a question about the balance of power or assumptive worlds within the World Bank. Does this mean that the neoliberal economists are going to make way for a more subtle behavioural approach and perhaps for psychologists, although they're now called behavioural economists because that's the only way they can win Nobel Prizes?
Yeah, so I don't know about neoliberal, but maybe neoclassical. You know, I would say that, you know, to the extent there's been a little bit of resistance to this agenda in development, it may come from people who are a little bit leery of government involvement in the economy and who believe very strongly that individuals are expressing their desires through their revealed preferences. And if they, in fact, are not working hard, it's because they don't want to be. If they're not signing up for financial assistance, it's because they really prefer not to. Understandably, that's a, you know, it's a powerful view. And I think, you know, getting back to one of David's questions, you know, we try and focus on some of these core basic capabilities, you know, health, education. You know, we don't necessarily think this is a general reason to intervene in the economy at large, because there are all kinds of instances and exchanges in which people aren't doing what they want to be doing. We think we ought to target it on these core development questions. But that view is still out there. But I think that, generally speaking, the evidence is pretty strong. You know, Richard Thaler was asked during an interview, well, is this another fad, or is this really here to stay? He said, well, unlike some of the other management fads that have taken place, the evidence base is fairly strong for behavioral economics. And I think that's right. And I think even people like, you know, neoclassical economists are beginning to recognize that.
It's Anne James, RSA fellow. And really, I hear what you say, and I understand the psychology of it, but the assumption is that somehow this is for a good purpose. And I would query that in terms of manipulation. I ask because we're currently in the UK going through a process where the notion of scroungers on benefits is being transferred to a more positive notion of supporting people in work. But the underlying aim of that is actually to reduce welfare benefits, which may or may not be regarded as a good thing. So we're seeing a kind of mindset being changed, which may or may not, depending on our values, be used in the way we want it to be used. I'd just like your comments on that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I won't comment on the UK context. I don't know it well enough to do so. But I will say that these are tools. You know, like any tools, they can be used for a variety of purposes. You know, regulation can be used for good or ill. Taxation can be used for good or ill. Conscription can be used for good or ill. There's a great example that Cass Sunstein describes about how what matters is what matters are the uses of this rather than the instrument. And he says, well, if we wanted to encourage civic mindedness, we may have a view that it's great to participate in political life. We have a lot of people out there that aren't tied to any political party and they're, you know, couldn't care less about politics, and that's bad. So why don't we automatically enroll them in a political party? Let's make them a Tory. They could opt out if they want and become Labour, but let's just start them somewhere. Now, that's an unacceptable use of a default, you know, of an automatic enrollment. And so it's not so much the tool itself, but I think it's the uses for which it's, you know, it can be used. The uses can be varied, and one can question, you know, the legitimacy of them. So I won't comment on the UK context, except just to say I don't know enough to say what the intended use of that policy, you know, is. But generally speaking, these are tools that can be used in a variety of ways.
Varun, Brendan Martin, Public World. Varun, thank you for the talk. Carrying on from your previous answer, isn't it also the case, though, that some of these tools are more available to the automatic thinking mindset, whereas some of them require deliberative engagement with the challenge of changing social norms? And are you finding in the bank that the nudge piece of this, rather than the anthropological piece of it, if you follow me, is finding a better reception? And if so, what kind of challenge does that represent for the training of your colleagues in the bank?
Yeah. So I think that the take-up of the thinking automatically, the behavioral economics part of it, has been pretty good, partly because it's a relatively well-trodden path. You know, we have people who, you know, like the Behavioral Insights team here in the UK, who have developed a set of interventions that can travel. And so people think we should try them as well. But there is a bit of a pushback from people who say, well, look, you know, automatic enrollments are fine, but most countries don't have safety nets programs to begin with. You can sort of, you know, nudge electricity consumption behavior, but you've got to have electricity hook up to even for that to be a value. Changing tax compliance is fine, but what if the government's using the money for arms, which are then being used against its citizens? So the pushback is almost, you know, from some quarters of the institution, we really need the social side here because the development challenges are very big in comparison to some of the challenges that, you know, rich countries experience. And so to really change the development side, you need to think about the legitimacy of government, trust in government, corruption, you know, governance stories, you know, outdoor defecation, I mentioned, you know, these large social practices, gender roles. And so I think there's a division here, but it's almost, from some quarters, it's almost the opposite. And people are saying that, you know, the nudge is not enough. For development, really do need the social side. And, you know, as we discussed, there isn't as much pushback on that in the development world because it already is a project in which we're trying to change preferences.
Tom Wines from the Center for Applied Intelligence. Bank projects, development projects in general, have a lot of process involved in them. There's log frames and theories of change and all that. At what point does behavioral science fit in? At what point do you decide you're going to use some behavioral science?
Yeah. So one of the tasks we hope to do, one of the activities we hope to engage in as we move forward is to have for project teams social and behavioral insights workshops at the design stage. The thought is that almost any project can potentially benefit from social and behavioral insights. And let's regularly, as much as we can, given capacity constraints, have conversations at the design stage to say, well, what can we do? And, you know, you can see that it's almost universally relevant because, you know, communication can be easy or complex. And why not make it easy? It's simple. In developing countries, you often have this odd mismatch between, you know, colonial legacies which leave public discourse in a kind of legalese and relatively low levels of literacy. And so people don't understand what government's saying often a lot of the time. And so any project involves communication. So there's the potential for insights anywhere. And then finally, during the implementation stage, you know, as I mentioned, we want to sort of go to this sort of spiral process where we can sort of look into what's working, what's not, and then hopefully bring that feedback in to adapt projects as they go forward.
Thank you very much, Farhan. Yason Gabriel from Oxford University. So one of the things that you highlighted in your talk was the limitations of mental models that people use. But of course, this whole behaviorist turn can be understood as a mental model that we're now kind of allying ourselves with. So I was wondering what limitations you thought this model might bring with it, what blind spots it engenders, and particularly whether you think that this emphasis on kind of free behavioral change might actually become an excuse for not investing in international development.
Yeah. So there are some dangers for sure. You know, one of the concerns is that if you focus on cognitive limitations, and it's true that being free from worry lifts your cognitive abilities, that, you know, we may sort of develop certain stereotypes of the people we're trying to help. And we may think, well, you know, there's a history of blaming people for their problems. And I think that's something we need to be very careful and very mindful of, and it's a potential danger, you know, when one adopts this mental model. And there's also the, you know, you also mentioned, yes, and the challenge of making sure that this isn't replacing other kinds of interventions. You know, we still need taxation, we still need regulation. And getting back to the climate change question, you know, it's hard to visualize a major solution that doesn't involve a price on carbon. I don't think we can somehow spontaneously start behaving differently without that kind of support. So it shouldn't be an excuse to set aside some of the other tools that we find very effective. Now, Thaler said there's evidence for this, and I think that's right. It's complicated, though, you know, and I think we shouldn't fall prey to the idea that it's all complicated, you know, and we need to sort of figure out what's going on here and turn to psychology. And I think there are a lot of challenges that psychology has a hard time addressing. You know, I was at a presentation where Daniel Kahneman was speaking, and Kahneman was asked, so this is great, but what can you do about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? you know, and he said, you know, some problems are just too hard. And so, you know, that's obviously has something to do with behavior, something to do with mental models, that conflict. But there's something about power, there's something about, you know, history that's remains that we don't, you know, that we can't quite crack. So we shouldn't think we have the answer to everything just because we understand more things about decision making.
Just a concluding comments from me. I do think one of the great challenges for us, and, you know, we should walk before we can run, but, I mean, sort of joking aside, group conflict and so on, it is one of the questions as to whether this is an area, like the literature, can move beyond, important though it is, including our own work, tax letters and so on, prompting in relation to what's the right time to make an offer around fertilizer, into, well, a lot of those very deep human conflicts, you know, are... they look like they've got deep behavioural roots. And one of the questions is, does the, not just the psychologist, but a wider kind of behavioural community, do we have something else coming through the literature with some of those great challenges? Well, I do think you've given us a real sense of an issue which we wrestle with a lot. Of course, our own focus was very much certainly on the UK, and now even though we work for other governments and behavioural insight team, it tends to be OECD countries. And one of the questions we were always asked is around, yeah, but would it ever work in any other country or context? I think we know now pretty decisively that it does. The work that you mentioned that we've been doing with you guys on the world on tax collection in Guatemala, incredibly similar sets of results to what we've seen in the UK. So social norms might differ, but the effect of social norms look like they're a kind of near universal phenomenon. So it's a really exciting area for those, you know, who we really look forward to see what happens next with the World Bank, indeed more generally. And Varun, thank you so much for a really interesting event.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.